jumping. Yes, it is, girl. Everybody's having a good time. You know what's going on my mind. Now, would you mind if I get comfortable and kick off these shoes? You know what? Now, somebody needs to fix me a drink.
That's how you start the day today on a Friday when it's Free Your Mind Friday. The daddy she is referring to is, in fact, her pa. Gospel pianist, blues, jazz pianist Gene Harris laying the groundwork for his daughter, Nikki, singing Down Home Blues, the title track from his 1997 album, The Great Jack McDuff. We'll hear a little bit from him later on the trusted Hammond B3 organ. We have Ron Eschete on guitar, Luther Hughes on bass, and Paul Humphrey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. It is the gathering place for the exchange of information, opinions, and ideas. You get to tell us what your take on the world this past week has been and continues to be. And you bring to our attention things that you think warrant further discussion and debate. No mincing of words here, although, of course, we observe due decorum and mutual respect. But the idea is to share your thoughts and to contribute by doing so to the building of community. How do we do this? We call 888-874-4888 and we start the conversation. What do you think about the last week's programs and this week's programs? Anything in particular that you want to take issue with or add to? Or the news in general, what's going on in the headlines, things that you think should be further discussed. 888-874-4888. This is your time and you're driving. You're in the driver's seat. Well, we start in New York with Joel. Hello, Joel. You're on the air.
Hi, Teresa. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You've had some really good programs this week.
Thank you.
And let's hope that it creates a small storm. Actually, I don't really want to talk too much about that or about the political carnival that's going on, as I think I mentioned last week or so. I'm suffering a little fatigue from that. Although I must say I'm tempted to talk about what Clinton said the other day, what she said the other day when she gave that foreign policy address at San Diego. But I won't. All I'll say about that is that she exposed herself for the warmonger that she is and that she's the obvious candidate for the war party. We should be concerned. Anyway, what I'd like to really talk about is perhaps I could call it the elephant cometh. Because the elephant is not even in the room. which is why this 2000 election campaign, which I just referred to, is such a soap opera. The elephant outside the room is really called discontinuity. And I know that's a kind of intimidating word, but it's exactly what the country is in for. And, you know, I've alluded to this in the past, but it's been on my mind in the midst of all this nonsense that we've been subjected to. And it means that a lot of familiar things are going to come to an end. They're going to stop and aren't going to work the way they're supposed to, beginning manifestly with this election process that's now underway and all of its unprecedented bizarreness. And one reason why it's difficult to comprehend this kind of discontinuity, this kind of discontinuity, is because so many of our operations and institutions in this country have become rackets. And what I mean by that is that they are kept going only by dishonest means. And if we didn't lie to ourselves about them, they couldn't continue. So I'd like to just talk about a few of them briefly. The first is the automobile racket. And, you know, throughout my life, and I'm sure throughout yours as well, we've all known that without a solid, solvent middle class, you can't sell cars. And Americans are used to paying for cars on installment loans. And if the middle class is so crippled by debt and the disappearance of good-paying jobs that they can't qualify for car loans, then the answer is to give them loans anyway on terms that don't really pencil out, such as 7-year loans at 0% interest for used cars. That'll be worth next to nothing long before the loan expires. And this will go on until it can't. And that is what discontinuity is about. And the car companies and the banks, with help from government regulators and political cheerleaders, have created this situation by treating subprime car loans as essentially they treated subprime mortgages. They bundle them into large packages of bonds, and then they are sold mainly to big pension funds and insurance companies who want higher interest on safe investments that ostensibly preserve their principal. So all this amounts to the revenue streams of payments that are going to stop because the payers, by definition, aren't creditworthy, which means that it was all baked in the cake that they would quit making payments, especially when they go underwater, owing ever more money than they could even imagine. So that's one. The other one is health care, which is now such a blatant, odious, and ruinous racket that it's very difficult to believe that it hasn't ignited an outright revolution, or at least a workplace massacre, in some insurance company C-suite. It's well known that, you know, most Americans don't even have $500 to pay for a car repair. How are they going to cope with $5,000 deductible health insurance incidents? And the answer is they can't. Their mental health is destroyed in the process of attempting to fix their physical health. This is going on all over the country, and not uncommonly, they have to declare bankruptcy after a routine appendectomy or a visit to the emergency room with a set of broken arm, and sometimes they don't even bother going to the doctor, and this really plays out in poor communities over and over again. And, of course, the pharmaceutical industry has been allowed to convert itself into a simple extortion racket. Have a serious disease? We have something that might help. It might cost $43,000 a month. And what kind of polity allows this kind of cruel and indecent grift to go on? Why, the Obama administration, which allowed the health insurance company lobbyists and their colleagues in Big Pharma to craft the Affordable Care Act. The name, by the way, Utrice, which must be the biggest public lie ever floated. And finally, there's banking, the financial system. Certainly the greatest racket of rackets since the fumes it's running on. Combinations of zero interest rate policy, now negative interest rate policy, which is accompanying quantitative easing, and what they call forward guidance, which is the happy talk that you get on CNBC and all these other business stations, is all that there is to maintain the illusion that money remains a reliable gauge of value. Finance is the racket, I'm telling you, finance is the racket that will go down first and hardest, and when it does, all the other rackets that are currently running will go up in favor, including the higher education racket, which is all I've got about that. $1 trillion in student debt, enormous salaries going to these administrators who used to come at least out of the faculty, but now are just corporate administrators. So that's going too. So finance will go down first and hardest, and when it does, all the other rackets that are currently running will go up in a vapor. So the elephant will storm into the room maybe even this kind of elephant that it might happen before the political conventions. Maybe it might happen after, but it's going to happen. And when it does, it will usher in the recognition that nothing can go on as before. And that means that we have to have leadership that is aware of what is coming. And I don't hear about any of this in the campaign. Do you?
Not at all. And there's no incentive, really. There's no the reason for them to do this because they will be pointing fingers at themselves. So they have no interest at all in creating this level of awareness because they have to come into accountability for their roles, their respective roles in creating the crises that you're talking
You just gave a definition of narcissism. And that's what we're faced with all these people. You know, they're so self-absorbed, they have no idea what their policies are really doing to others. Really. I mean, the Clinton, I remember when earlier this week when Kim Ives was talking about the Clinton shenanigans in Haiti. I mean, these people actually think that they're doing good, that they're beneficent individuals.
I have a theory that they absolutely do not care. They are gangsters to the core. And all they are interested in is getting what they want. That's all. They are completely amoral about it. They have no particular reference point with regard to conscience or what's right. It's just, I want to get what I want to get, and everything must go in service of that. Thanks a lot for calling, Joel, and getting us started today.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Let's go to Virginia. Walter is waiting. Hello, Walter.
Hello, Utrice. Happy belated birthday.
Thank you so much. Thank you. What's on your mind today?
Well, first of all, you actually share a birthday with one of my absolute favorite aunts, and I think of you as an aunt as well because you're very, very instructional, very caring, and you spread a lot of love and to your PRN family. So I will refer to you as Aunt Utrice, if you don't mind, in a loving way.
Aunt Utrice, well, it's funny. I got that just yesterday. Somebody called me auntie, and I said, wait a minute here. I'm just 22. What are you talking about? But anyway, thank you so much. So share your thoughts with us.
On an honorary basis. What I'd like to say today is I was thinking a great deal about the piece that you played for Kwame Ture last week in terms of the creation and the maintenance and the sustaining of systems and how by the lack of those that we seem to be powerless against the so-called 1%. And many years ago, I attended a lecture for Dr. John Heinrich Clark. And in the lecture, someone had asked him a question about the death of Martin Luther King and what had basically happened to the black community as a unified community and the civil rights movement after his death that it seemed to kind of go into a spiral. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, bury the man and continue the plan. I thought about that, and I said, well, gee, well, as it stands today, what is our plan? And it seems that we might have a lack of a plan due to the lack of a unified front there in terms of actually implementing a plan. And so then I thought about, you know, Hillary Clinton and the pieces you played in her courting the black community, particularly through our faith tradition, our churches, and how many church leaders have basically partnered up with her to push her agenda to their congregations. And so I was doing some research, and you may be aware of there was a story a couple of years ago about President Bill Clinton fathering a black son by the name of Danny Lee Williams Jr.
Yes.
And how that story kind of rose for a hot second, and then it went away based on a paternity test that was tested by the Star newspaper over in England and Britain. And my thing is this, I believe we do have systems that are still at our disposal, and one of which that Gary always talks about is the Internet and our platforms for social communication through our social media, i.e. Twitter, and email and what have you. And my whole thing is, for those African Americans and those people of color who are leaning towards voting for Hillary Clinton, I think a very pertinent question would be to ask them then, why does she not acknowledge Danny Lee Williams Jr., okay, as a, you know, possible stepson to her husband? And basically, what are her thoughts on that and why she hasn't really acknowledged that in any capacity? Because the Starr report for the DNA report was concluded to be false. They actually never had a DNA report. There was no DNA test actually ever done. And when one goes out on the internet and looks at pictures of Danny Lee Williams Jr., the resemblance is uncanny to his father. And so my whole thing is, if Hillary is courting us and espouses, you know, black issues and wants to help the black community and the minority community, I think it would be incumbent upon us to ask those folks that are, you know, thinking about voting towards her, well, are you aware that, you know, she has not acknowledged a black son, and why hasn't she done that?
Very interesting question. In fact, it is on a different level. It is the story of plantation life, which is what is playing out on the political scene, that the Clintons have mined, M-I-N-E-D, mined the African-American community for its political power. And we talked about that. How is it that this constituency, along with the Latino community and many other so-called minority communities, as they call them, supposedly have no power, but yet have maintained and created power bases for people who continue to run the political structures just like regular plantations? There's no real connection there. Just give me your vote and get lost. And people do that. And their leaders encourage them to do that. Give your vote to the Democratic Party. Give your vote to Hillary. Well, why? What makes this woman qualified for this hard-won vote? What are her qualifications? What papers is she walking into the community with as being the candidate of choice, other than people saying, hey, we have placed ourselves in her service. We are the plantation overseers on a political level. And that's our job. Our job is to report that we have gotten everybody in line, and you can count on us. You know, it's ridiculous, but that's the way it is. I still take umbrage at the fact that when election time comes around, the one place that should be absolutely off limits to anybody in politics is the sanctity of the sanctuary in black churches on a Sunday. Why are people being paraded and you know, interrupting your one little chance to commune with your spiritual self? And you have this political disturbance, people being brought in into the sanctuary of churches to engage in the tawdry business of politics. I think it should be a national movement to say, you know, it's great that you recognize that the churches have some kind of connection to the community. If you wish to come to talk to our congregants, fine, but not on a Sunday. You are not going to enter our sanctuary to please your schedule and come and talk to us. We know you're a liar. We know who you are, and we're not going to have it. There's some things that are so sacred, you should never, ever, it should never be available to people like that. It's as simple as that. Thank you so much, Walter, for calling in today.
Thank you, Yatrice.
Thank you. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice.
How are you?
Oh, getting along. I had the mistake of having some bad cataract surgery, so I'm trying to recover and doing my best. But, you know, last week on Free Your Mind Friday, you had some very interesting people discuss certain things. One of the things that I know we all know is very important is how to look at the media, the corporate media, and then analyze how that works. About 2 weeks ago, the New York Times had a story about some Midwest city, I think in Ohio, and this is essentially about so-called black-on-black crime. They went into great detail about criminal situations of violence among black people and whatnot, and that whole story was just about that, you know, about the shootings and so forth. Now, what I've learned when, you know, I listen to you and people who know how to analyze things that they see in the media, nowhere in that whole story did anyone talk about the etiology or the causes of why these things are happening. Why is it that people learn such self-hatred? Why is it that these things occur? What damage has been done to these people, the black people that they're talking about in the article, economically and socially, that causes these types of situations to evolve? They leave that out completely. And, you know, it's not just the New York Times. It's in television, radio, and other forms of media. They're always talking about what's wrong with, for example, black people, and they never talk about what has been done to these people who are put in this position where they get involved in violent crime. I thought that was very important. I tried to get in, but I guess I got in too late. So that's one thing. The other thing, many people last week talked about sexual assault and, you know, it talked about how it had happened to them. Well, you know, as you probably noticed from my book, in the family, I've had that sort of thing. And what I'm getting at is that in many cases where people are sexually assaulted, like, you know, I imagine some of the people that called in, they never get past that post-traumatic stress. But the other element is that loved ones of the person who was assaulted, quite often that person is in a state of post-traumatic stress also. So I thought that would be an important thing to bring up, that some people recover, but other people never recover. So that was what I wanted to throw into the pot for people to look at. So it's a very, very serious problem about that area that should be looked at.
Well, thank you so much. Well, let's take a look at the two things you raised, black on black crime. Well, of course, there is great interest, and especially by the media being an extension of the power elite of this country with a specific function, and that function is to condition popular thought, to condition our attitudes toward things. Within the confines, the intellectual confines, the emotional, psychological, economic, political confines of an agenda already set. These groups,
yes,
they're groups who are targeted. It is no accident, of course, that Donald Trump predicated his, quote, success politically on attacking Mexicans and attacking other groups that are seen as politically unprotected, but also groups that are the targets, the emotional and psychological targets of the larger society. And the reason they become targets is, again, they are viewed as politically unprotected groups, groups that cannot fire back to the point where they have the ammunition to compel their attackers to behave differently.
Yes.
When they talk about black-on-black crime, it is reported as an incredible anomaly. The fact is, the people committing the bulk of crimes in the Italian community are Italians. The people committing the majority of crimes in the Lithuanian community are Lithuanian. The people committing large numbers of crimes in the Orthodox Jewish community are Orthodox Jews. It's the nature of crime. Crime exists in every particular community. So it is not unusual that in the African-American community, you will have crimes committed by African-Americans. That's the nature of crime.
Yes.
So it is not that there's something particularly pathological about this, except that if you understand it, and if we go back, and that's where I commend you for making that link and that point, there is an antecedent to all of this. There's context to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to get an idea about violent crime, read about New York, the gangs of New York at the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
When the Irish, roving in the streets, you read about the attacks, the open attacks, hundreds killed in 1919. Mm-hmm. The Irish gangs, the Italian gangs. You cannot imagine the level of violence and crime committed in this context. And the context there is also oppression. These groups were highly oppressed and highly pressurized groups. These groups were curtailed. They were contained in a pressure cooker.
Yes.
In New York, you must know, the Five Points area, the area that is now Wall Street, and that the environs of City Hall, where all of this was happening. And it is not unusual. You go all throughout the United States where these groups were forced to live together fighting for resources.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And structured so that they would continue to fight for resources because a system said they're all slaves. They're all expendable. And the few meager resources that we have, let them fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the idea is to say that there is a major concern, but the dialogue that must accompany this is a dialogue that says and puts into proper perspective the evolution of what they present to us as a unique kind of pathology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when somebody was remarking to me, there was a time when there was zero black unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Zero. Because everybody was enslaved.
Yes.
So the society thought it was great. Everybody's working.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was only the small matter of imposed slavery.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But that was not the main concern of society in general. They had it just the way they wanted it.
Absolutely.
So this is where the conversation needs to go. Why is it that these groups behave this way? And number one, it's not unusual. You go through the historical record and you see all kinds of cultural groups, all kinds of oppressed people exhibiting the same kind of psychological burnout and fallout. And it sometimes expresses itself in incomprehensible violence.
Yes.
But that, too, is part of the consequence of the condition of life.
Right. But the corporate media doesn't want to talk about that.
They don't. Because the whole idea is that everybody in the system of white supremacy, there is a great need to maintain the psychological illusion of dominance of one group over another. So anything negative you can associate with the group that is to be dominated, you use it. And that explains Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That explains the rabid right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the term white supremacy was not even mentioned in the article.
Right. You assign these negative attributes over and over again. You emphasize it over and over again until people are properly and thoroughly conditioned to accept mm-hmm. that this is the way they naturally are. Mm-hmm. And also, not only to enforce the negative, but to enforce from their point of view the positive part being, we are not like that. And mm-hmm. therefore, we have the right and the authority to keep them, as Hillary Clinton said, to bring them to heel.
Mm-hmm. Like a dog.
That's correct. And that's the sophisticated discussion that needs to be had, and it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yes.
I should remind those who are listening, you are David Strawn, the author of Playing the Game, and we should schedule something soon to talk about your book. It's a fascinating book, and you are an extraordinary man, and we should get that done quickly.
All right, so expect
a call from me.
Okay.
Thanks so much for calling today. Let's talk to Harvey from Berkeley. Hello, Harvey. How are you today?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, wonderful you trees. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'd like to talk about an important issue here in California and why it's so important to vote for Bernie Sanders. This is breaking news. The Obama administration just approved offshore fracking in the Santa Barbara Channel located in South Central California. And we know that both Trump and Hillary Clinton support the fossil fuel industry, and they side with the frackers. And Bernie wants to stop fracking in America. And we also know that fracking causes earthquakes, and we found this out in Oklahoma. And it turns out that there's a fault line called the Hawes-Gary Fault Line located in South Central California. And the Hawes-Gary Fault Line merges with other faults in California's Santa Barbara Channel, and it can produce earthquakes with a magnitude 7.5 or larger. And the Hawes-Gary Fault is also linked to the Shoreline Fault, which is also linked to the Diablo Cove Fault, which runs directly under Unit 1 nuclear reactor at the aging Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. And what happens in California affects America. A lot of food that America eats comes from the California Central Valley, and the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant is located right in front of the California Central Valley, and if there's a meltdown, the Diablo, there'll be a lot of produce will become radioactive. And at the same time, the Hawes-Gary Fault is also connected, is a component of the deadly San Andreas Fault system that can trigger a massive megathrust earthquake called the Big One up and down the California coast. And the second reason is because of saltwater intrusion into California's freshwater aquifers. Some of the poisonous fluids used in fracking are hydrochloric acid, magnesium peroxide, formic acid, petroleum distillate, acetic acid, zirconium, and tetramethyl ammonium. And because of California's ongoing severe drought, there's been overpumping of the freshwater aquifers for irrigation and drinking water, and so it's drawn the salt water inland, and it's called saltwater intrusion into our freshwater aquifers. And fracking in the Santa Barbara Channel will carry these fracking fluids into California's freshwater aquifers, especially around Santa Barbara, causing cancer as well as a variety of other illnesses, putting California's men, women, and children in harm's way. So Bernie's against fracking, and a vote for Bernie is a vote against fracking.
Well, I got to ask you, your illustrious governor, Jerry Brown, has endorsed the other Democrat running, Hillary Clinton. What do you think about that?
Well,
what does that say about Jerry Brown's own commitment, his supposedly steadfast commitment to environmentalism?
Jerry Brown used to be a number so-called environmentalist, but it turns out that his family actually got a lot of their wealth from the petroleum industry. They're involved in the petroleum industry, so I wouldn't be surprised if Jerry Brown is with Hillary in voting for more petroleum development. But I feel that he's just trying to cover his political bets, but I feel it's a wrong bet. And California is in, you know, it's earthquake country here, and you don't want to start fracking in earthquake country because the end product is lots of death and destruction.
Well, thank you, Harvey. It's always a learning curve when you call in and you let us know what's going on with the environment and the whole world.
Thank you.
It's a fascinating peer education that we get through your calls. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We'll take this short break, come back to your calls at 888-874-4888 right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and that's one of my favorite Hammond B3 organ players. That's Jack McDuff. And we're continuing with your calls at 888-874-4888. It's Free Your Mind Friday. We have David, the other David from Brooklyn.
Happy birthday, Patrice.
Thank you. Thanks so much. What's on your mind today?
Many, many more. And there are people out there who say they love you. They have to pray for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
The sum is greater than the one. So it must be math.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's on
Tell
my
me
mind.
What you're thinking today. What's on your mind?
Joel's first call, that was great. But he left one thing out. The energy cartels. And what I mean by that is the future of energy is really plasma technology. And don't ask me to explain that because I'm not a physicist. But I know everything's made of plasma, and they're keeping this secret because they want to keep using the oil and et cetera. Do you follow that?
Yes, I'm listening. Mm-hmm.
They're never going to give it up. Somehow, some physicist has to figure out the way to use this plasma for energy. And once they
do that... I'm like you with this plasma thing. I have no idea about it. So this is a thing I will have to start reading up on and to figure out how plasma and the relationship between plasma and the production of energy. See, I learn something new every day.
Well, most people think when I say plasma, it's blood.
No.
Oh, you even know that. So that's great.
So why do you think that there is an interest in keeping us tied to fossil fuel energy?
I'm glad you asked that because that's easy for me to answer. Usually you give me hard ones. It's all about the money. The greed, too. These people are so rich. The great-great-grandchildren, they could live in luxury for the rest of their lives. They don't care. They want to keep it going. That's one of the main secrets that these people have.
Has this in any way changed how you personally... deal with this question of energy and the consumption of energy as an individual?
No, I always thought they were keeping something back because of Nikola Tesla. He knew about it. That's how he was able to get the free energy. It has to do with plasma. I can't see what else it has to do with. But as I said, I'm not a physicist. I can't explain the plasma.
Well, I am going to take a look at this thing because I'm hearing it for the first time from you, and it's something that should be looked into. So I'll begin to do some homework on that.
The top physicist should be looking to do that. They're being suppressed. There's a physicist named, what's his name? He's Dutch. I'm wasting time here because I can't remember his name. Well, anyway, he's the one that found out about this for sure. Because of the study of crop circles, the real ones, not the ones that were made by these guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's something. I mean, this is something that you just planted a seed in my head, and I'm going to try and do some preliminary looking into it.
And how do you feel, by the way?
I feel great. I do. I have a little cold, but I feel fine.
I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you so much, David.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call today.
Okay, bye.
From Chicago, Chi-Town, it's Henry.
Hey, Utrice, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. Happy birthday again.
Thank you.
Really, really appreciate you and appreciate your work.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to add in on that conversation about what David, the author, was talking about in regards to crime in the black community because, you know, me growing up in Chicago, and this is something that's very interesting. When you look at the FBI crime statistics from the early 90s in Chicago, did you know for like 3 years in a row, there were 900 gun deaths? Now, I think last year in Chicago, there were about maybe 600. And the thing about it was, and I remember growing up, you know, on the south side of Chicago back then about the number of people, who were killed by gunfire because, you know, we were still in the era of, we were still high in the era of the crack, you know, the crack industry. Because, as you know, with a lot of the major cities, crack started to pour into the communities, back as early as the early 80s. And there was a huge gang problem, you know, during that time in Chicago. But, you know, the thing was that, there was nobody during that time talking about, oh, we got a big problem in Chicago. Even though there were over 900 gang-related deaths, you know, during that time. And the thing, too, is that during that time, everybody was focused and concentrated on Los Angeles because that was, you know, where the big gang war and the Crips and Bloods was at. But nobody was really looking at Chicago during that time. But the thing is that I think we all know that this was purposely done because if you look at Los Angeles now, there are hardly any African Americans in Los Angeles now. And it was purposely done for the simple fact of, you know, gentrification. And they did a real good job in Los Angeles doing that. And we're in the beginning process. We're not in the beginning process, but we're in the middle processes of gentrification here in Chicago. So the numbers aren't the big factor because, like I said, you could go into the 90s and pull up bigger numbers than what we're getting now. But the whole purpose is the media is blasting this because of the fact that, you know, gentrification is the ultimate goal of this reporting of, you know, why all this black-on-black violence, you know, in Chicago. And then I also wanted to talk about this because I know you had Gerald Horn yesterday, and I was hoping you would have got some calls about, you know, to
we
ask
have
Gerald
to,
Horn.
We have to schedule Gerald Horn to just take questions.
Yeah.
We just have to do that.
But I wanted to ask him because, you know, and this sort of relates on what he was talking about because he was talking about the Asian pivot, you know, yesterday. But I wanted to ask him about the, as you know, my mother's Filipino, and the Philippines just elected a new president, Rodrigo Duterte.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of media outlets here have been reporting him as the quote-unquote Filipino Donald Trump.
Now, when I communicate with some of my cousins in the Philippines, you know, they think he's being fairly untreated by Western media by calling him that, because he's a very staunch advocate against corruption, which has plagued the Philippines for decades. And this is talking about political corruption, because his one main focal point was to rid political corruption in the Philippines, which he feels, and I kind of feel the same way as well, which he feels is the basis of a lot of the social ills of the Philippines. And it's interesting how he talks about political corruption, but none of the presidential candidates here have uttered a word about political corruption within our own society. So it's a very interesting thing. But I wanted to ask you what was the United States take on him being president? Because I know he doesn't have a very good relationship with the United States, because when he was mayor of Davao, which is in Mindanao in the southern Philippines, he was against the United States was talking about putting a drone base nearby the city, and he was utterly against that. And so it's a very contentious relationship between him and the United States, because he feels that the United States has too much military, you know, within the Philippines itself. So he's looking to become more independent of the military intervention of the United States. But he's also talking about doing a lot of talking with the Chinese, which they are disputing a lot of islands that's between China and the Philippines in that area. Obviously, the United States doesn't want to negotiate anything, but he's willing to sit down and talk to the Chinese in regards to this. So I wanted to ask him, you know, what he knows about Washington's feeling on, you know, the new incoming president of the Philippines.
Well, we'll take a look at that, because there are so many aspects to it that should, you know, be discussed. Number one is, of course, he is a strong man. There's no question about it. You could dance around it all we want, but there are dictatorial aspects to Mr. Duterte, and he has already, I mean, he's getting it's the same kind of reaction from Donald Trump as Donald Trump by saying outrageous things. He said, you know, he's going to increase business for the funeral directors, for example, because he intends to ramp up executions for small crimes, even. He intends to obliterate the criminal class by just killing them. And he wants them not even firing squad, he says, because that's too expensive. It's better to snap their necks. This kind of language is very, very off-putting. And he has called the Pope a son of a whore.
Yeah.
he's been very outrageous in his behavior. And that's why the comparison with Donald Trump. His mouth is in overdrive, and his brain seems to be sometimes in neutral or even in reverse. So this is a cause of concern when you are supposedly leadership material. People get really skittish about these kinds of things, because history is replete with examples of people who behave like this and what they end up doing to the entire nation. And the ripple effects of that as well. It's, you know, people will cheer them on. It's like in Haiti, they loved Papa Duck. They loved Baby Duck. Great stuff.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but look at what they did to the country. And the strong arm of the military is the cudgel that they wield against the people. And still the people are encouraged to support their own oppression through these dictatorial policies. It's very, very scary.
Yeah, and so, I'm waiting and seeing what's going to happen with him.
But you don't have to wait to see. You're seeing it already. I wanted to talk about the first point that you raised as well, this business about Chicago and gang warfare. Chicago, and this is a particularly interesting example of how race plays into perceptions of violence. Mm-hmm. When Chicago was strictly in the hands of white gangsters, strictly.
I mean, oh yeah,
they were the ones doing the killing and the maiming and the, you know, the arsoning, the arson and all kinds of crazy stuff going on in Chicago. They owned the criminal world. We had no reports of the pathology of whites there.
Well,
we didn't see that. We got reports, you know, sometimes even romanticized reporting about, you know, the way that they have conducted the executions of fellow criminals, and the pictures were there. It was a big industry.
Well, yeah, most Chicago historians, and like you said, there's no official numbers, but during the Prohibition era, they estimated that there were over 1,000 deaths in Chicago a year. I mean, that was just a rough estimate.
And that was at the time when booze, and during the Prohibition era, booze was to Chicago and the criminal world what crack cocaine and drugs might be today in particular communities. But the point I'm making is no one would have suggested, and no one did suggest, that the criminal element, despite all of the things that they were doing that were so atrocious, were basically unfit for membership in the white world. They explained it as criminal activity, but not as racial inferiority. There was no pathology associated with it, except, you know, there would sometimes you'd see articles about the fact that, you know, they had a deformed head, or they came from an alcoholic home, and these kinds of things. But you would not see the pathologizing of the criminal element when it was totally white. When America's prisons were almost exclusively stocked with white criminals, we had no major discussion nationally about the pathology of white crime. We never heard of white-on-white crime. We still don't hear about white-on-white crime.
Yeah.
But we do hear about black-on-black crime, because it is especially pathological, and it is strategically used to condition both the white community and the African American community as well, to let people know there's something particularly pernicious among you, and you ought to root it out.
Well, you treat but remember during that time, the Italians and the Irish weren't really considered white Americans during that
time.
So in a sense, they were kind of ostracized. But you know, when they became quote unquote Americanized, then that's when all the attention turned towards African Americans.
But they were at it quite long enough to benefit from the wealth. The Kennedys are a perfect example of this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they began amassing wealth in the Prohibition era.
Yeah, that's true.
So you know, it is not without precedent that you find that there's a marked distinction in the way the media and society in general will deal with criminality and the pathology of criminality when it pertains to whites and when it pertains to others.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very fascinating. But your guy in Manila is to be watched. It's a very serious situation developing there. And we'll see how people react to it. He's certainly not going to be tolerating any protests. He made that very clear. There will be no protests against the government.
That's what concerns me, too.
There will be widespread arrests. There will be summary executions. In fact, he has encouraged the nation to basically take matters into their own hands. When the police tell you to stop, if you don't stop, they should execute you on the spot. He has said these things. Mm-hmm. And he intends to enact them as policy. And the odd thing is, a lot of people, I mean, he's getting more and more popular, becoming more and more popular. The more outrageous he gets, the more popular he gets, just like somebody we know on this side of the pond.
Yeah, which concerns me because my family members in the Philippines have split on him as well. So I want to make sure I keep in touch with them to get, you know, to get what's going on over there.
Yeah. Well, you also will see some reaction from the U.S. Filipino community. And that's one of the markers as to how things are going down. You know, there are many people here based in the U.S., Filipinos based in the U.S., a large community, and they will have some kind, I imagine, some kind of impact on Mr. Duterte and his policies.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Great to hear from you, Henry. Wonderful to hear from you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I love Free Your Mind Friday because people get to just trade in ideas, and we get to educate each other. It's wonderful peer education. Look how much we are learning from each other. And no one person is more capable of educating than another. We all have something to throw in the pot that would cause us to say, hey, I never thought about that. Maybe I should check this out. So this is good peer-to-peer education, and I thank you always for the integrity of your thoughts and the respect that you exhibit as you share your ideas and thoughts. It's not about trying to tell you what to think or what to say. It is about saying, whatever you have to say, we automatically extend authenticity and integrity to it. But of course, we don't want to offend each other. We say what we have to say with mutual respect. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. Now, here's somebody who always gives you something new to think about. So you want to stay tuned and get this new message today. You can reach me at Lead Stories, LEID Stories at gmail.com. A pleasure always, always, and a great privilege to be in your esteemed company. I look forward to it all the time. And again, thank you so much for your good wishes and your thoughts and prayers. I do appreciate it. And as you can tell, I am benefiting from your thoughts and prayers and good wishes. So thanks. We'll see each other on Monday. Alton Maddox comes to us on Monday.